Welcome to Science Questions. This is Sherry Quinn. The producers at SQ Radio have been covering climate change since scientific data on its effects started trickling out over a decade ago. It is moving faster now, and the pace of stories coming out in an array of media sources about the cascading effects of the Earth's warming temperature has rapidly increased in recent years. In our continuing coverage of the issue, today on the program, we hear from two reporters who recently visited the front lines of climate change. PBS NewsHour traveled to the Arctic this summer, where temperatures are warming twice as fast as any other place on the planet. They produced a three-part series in collaboration with the Pulitzer Center and the Seattle Times called Coping with Climate Change, Arctic Thaw. Melting sea ice is affecting the daily lives of the residents in the Pacific Northwest, Alaska, and beyond. The PBS broadcast highlights the impact of ocean acidification caused by carbon dioxide emissions on the fishing industry, the surge in marine traffic due to the melting ice that has opened up new waterways, and how the effects of climate change and increased oil and gas extraction are affecting traditional ways of life for Native Alaskans. PBS producers April Brown and Mike Fritz recently went there to report on how Native Alaskans are coping with climate change on their subsistence lifestyle.
For Brower and Jack, today is simply another day at the office. They are often in search of walrus, seals, and when the season is right twice a year, they go for the biggest prize of them all, bowhead whales. The marine mammal has been at the center of Inupiat culture for generations. All of their catch will later be shared with their family and friends.
I guess you could say it's a certain standing within your community. You provide for your community, you assist others with providing for your community. It's like a job. You have a job and you need workers. Well, you catch a walrus or a whale or a seal, and they don't get paid with money. They get paid with the shares from these animals. It's a great bounty.
It's part of a subsistence tradition that has been handed down over centuries and includes hunting land animals and birds as well.
This is our garden, our grocery store, you know. You can pretty much live off the land.
This lifestyle can be traced back to 400 AD, when the first humans settled around present-day Barrow. But Michael Donovan worries that because of rising temperatures and melting sea ice, future generations may not be able to live this way.
Yeah, it's definitely changing a lot, and it's kind of hard to say, you know, if our younger generations will be able to do what we do.
Barrow, Alaska, located 330 miles north of the Arctic Circle, is America's northernmost town. There are about 4,800 residents, and half are Inupiat Eskimos. The sun never sets in the summer, and winter temperatures regularly go down to negative 30 degrees. There aren't any trees, and goods and services have to be shipped in by barge from Anchorage. So the cost of living is high, 278% higher than the average cost to live in the continental United States, according to the PBS report. April and Mike started their trip from Seattle, where they talked to scientists and then boarded a NOAA ship.
And getting on a NOAA ship, a ship that had gone up and done some charting of the seafloor in the Arctic through the Bering Strait up into the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas. Then we went to Kodiak and got on another NOAA ship that actually ran us through the technology that they used to chart the seafloor, which is an interesting process. They took us out on a little launch and showed us how they basically kind of mow the ocean floor, mow the lawn with sonar, and we were able to see the outline of a shipwreck. So it really vividly brings that technology to life. We spent a few days in Kodiak and then went up to Barrow for about 4 days, and you're asking about the challenges. One of the challenges in Alaska is you are beholden to the weather. There is a lot of fog. There's, especially in the winter, even more serious weather. And I know Mike and I got split up because we had a trouble with one of our airplanes. So there wasn't enough room on one plane. And he ended up trying to fly into Barrow, and it was so foggy they couldn't land. And he had to turn around and fly back to Anchorage. So it's, but you know, you run into that, I guess, anywhere there's weather involved. But people tell us that that's kind of normal and you have to expect it and just kind of go with the flow.
I mean, we got on the flight from Anchorage, and then we circled Barrow probably 4 or 5 times, and then they just said, "Well, we can't see the runway, so we're heading back to Anchorage." And it was really interesting because a lot of the people on the plane, especially coming from kind of an East Coast style of lifestyle where everyone is, you know, upset if somebody doesn't make a right turn on time. I mean, everyone on the plane was just like, "Oh, it happens all the time," you know, and it was just totally, they didn't even seem that upset by it, which I thought was like amazing, because it's about a 2-2.5 hour flight from Anchorage, and you know, we circle and then just go back and land at the same airport, so you're up in the air for, you know, 4-4.5 hours, and you didn't go anywhere. So it was pretty wild.
How much footage did you gather, and what were your work days like?
I mean, we shot probably for about 10 to 12 days, I'd say. So I would imagine we have somewhere in the ballpark of, you know, 250 to 300 gigabytes worth of footage.
And the sun doesn't set up there, so you can start early in the morning and pretty much go 24 hours if you were inclined. But we usually ended at least up in Barrow around 11 p.m., so they're really long days because you've got daylight all the time.
I mean, there's a golden hour there that lasts for about 6 hours, so it's really nice.
And how was the weather up there?
It wasn't too bad, actually, now. It was probably in the 40s, generally. Some days even got up to about, you know, in the mid-50s. I mean, there was one day where we were like, "Hey, this is really nice." But, you know, in general, I would say it was probably about 40, 45 degrees where you'd have to wear kind of a fleece and gloves. And then there was a couple days that, there's one day where I went out seal hunting with some native Inupiat Eskimos, and it was pretty cold out on the Arctic Ocean. I mean, I was dressed as if I were going skiing or something, so it was definitely cold out there.
And we also shot in Kodiak and Anchorage, and they were experiencing a little bit of a warm spell, so it was beautiful weather and sunny skies for the most part. I don't think we got barely a drop of rain on us.
Yeah, that was really nice.
What was the inspiration for this particular project?
The NewsHour has been doing a continuing series on climate change, and we were asked if we'd be willing to go up to Alaska and take a look at what was going on up there, particularly with the Arctic sea ice. So just doing some general research and looking back at some of the pieces that we've done on ocean acidification elsewhere and the other issues that are going on up there, kind of thought it would be a good idea to look at some of the science related to the expected increased shipping traffic, and also how these kinds of things are affecting people up there. So the folks in Barrow really are on what some scientists have called, you know, the front lines of climate change, because the sea ice that they count on for so many things, for hunting, for the bringing in the food that feeds the whales and the walruses that they actually hunt, the sea ice has retreated, and so some of their food sources have retreated along with it. And it's so expensive to live up there. They have to have all of their goods, food, for the most part, shipped in. So the cost of living is really expensive, and I thought it'd be really interesting to see how these people have been particularly affected. And it was very interesting. They were open to sharing how they are having a really hard time hunting bowhead whales, which they have permission to do from the International Whaling Commission. They're allowed a certain amount every year. And the walruses and the seals that they also hunt have been slowly drifting away from the coast where they used to be able to get them.
How were you able to gain access and interviews within the community? What were the challenges?
Yeah, we were working really closely with a group of folks who generally help scientists with their research. They use their local knowledge to make sure that they're safe and they can go about getting what they need, you know, as efficiently as possible. Working and living up there is an entirely different world, especially in the wintertime when temperatures can get to 40 below. So we were working closely with these Inupiats who help scientists, and they were also really willing to share their own personal stories.
And they were more willing to once we had gotten up there and met them. And April could talk more about this, but I know she was struggling to lock down some of the stories because I think there is some fear that, you know, they didn't know what we were going to report on. They didn't know how it was going to be portrayed. And there was also just, and it, that might have been one issue, and the other issue might have been that, you know, the cell phone connections there weren't ideal. And sometimes during the summer, people in Alaska would, you know, they would tell us constantly, like, well, we're just taking 2 weeks off to go caribou hunting, and nobody knows where exactly, and then we'll see them, you know, see them back in a few weeks. And so that's, so that was definitely kind of an interesting dynamic of reporting a story, in the sense of we kind of went up there and we were like, well, hopefully this works out, because we're a long way from Washington. So
Mike was actually able to go along with them on a hunt on the ocean in search of seals.
The hunting experience was great, but no, we did not actually get any seals. And because the water got a little bit choppy, and the boat that we were in was, you know, fit only three people comfortably, so it was small. And, you know, I think they kind of decided that, hey, this is definitely not safe to go any further, because the wind started picking up. To be honest, it really wasn't much of a hunt. They checked their nets again, and they ended up getting some more fish on the, they kind of string out their nets along what's called point barrow. And that's the way that they fish, is they just kind of leave them there, and then fish actually swim into the net. So they were able to get, when we were with them, they were able to get some salmon and some other fish, but we actually never saw seals or a walrus or anything like that, even though the intention was to.
A strong sense of community has helped the Inupiat preserve some of their traditions, April explains.
That's a very interesting tradition that they have. When a whaling captain or whaling crew lands a whale, they actually believe that the whales give themselves up to the hunters. That whale gets harvested and gets shared with the entire community. They have a big celebration, and everybody comes, and then they will distribute the whale meat among themselves, the hunters, and then also to the community. So it's really a long-standing tradition of people helping each other. And I'm sad because they didn't actually land a whale during whaling season. They did get one just outside of their traditional whaling season. We were a little late to see that, but I hear the celebrations around it are quite lovely.
From your own perspective, can you talk about their outlook on climate change and what is happening with the ocean and what they are seeing on the ground or on the ice?
You know, there are good things and bad things that have come from melting sea ice that have affected them. In one respect, it opens up areas for oil exploration, and the folks of the North Slope derive a lot of revenue from that. But at the same time, it's making it much more difficult to continue a lot of their traditions, the hunting. They keep all of their hunted food in ice cellars, which are basically large holes in the tundra and the permafrost. And as the permafrost warms up, their ice cellars are no longer able to keep that meat cold. And if they depend on that year-round to keep their food source, their food fresh, you know, a lot of their meat, they tell us, has been rotting. So while they do get money from oil leases, a lot of their traditions are being made much more difficult. So in some respects, they just try to deal with it the best they can. But they want to make sure that, at least a lot of them that we met, that their children understand their ancestors and their heritage, and that that's not completely lost.
How accepted is the oil industry there, and what about other industries moving in as a result of the melting ice?
Well, I think the oil industry is the one that obviously it funds almost the entirety of the North Slope's governing budget. It's something like a $350 million governing budget, and pretty much taxes on the oil companies provide the entirety of that fiscal budget. And I think that most, I mean, at least the ones that we talk to, and this isn't by any stretch the whole community, but one guy that we talked to kind of was very resigned to the fact that, you know, they needed the industry, and that without the industry they wouldn't have schools, electricity, running water, and probably many employment options. So there's definitely, we found people who are afraid that, you know, their subsistence lifestyles could be changing dramatically in the future. I think a lot of people realize that, you know, at least in the short term, they need the industry.
How optimistic are they about the future of their environment, the people you talk to?
Well, I mean, I don't think anyone was necessarily pessimistic about it, I wouldn't say, but I will say that they were I would say, worried. I mean, one guy that we talked to, Michael Donovan, you know, kind of admitted that he said, you know, it's scary and I'm not sure. He's like, I don't know if our younger generations will be able to kind of do what we do. And he said at one point, too, that even if he was given $1 million or $100 million, I think is his quote, that he wouldn't, you know, trade this way of life for anything. So, I mean, even though there's kind of these opportunities along the North Slope because of the melting ice and things that have opened up, there's a lot of people up there that don't want them.
They're also trying to make their own opportunities. They've created their own corporation way back when they originally started dealing with the oil companies. They got a large sum of money and decided to create their own native corporations, so one of which is expanding shipping opportunities because, as I said before, they have to have so much of practically everything either shipped in or brought in by airplane, and so they wanted to take advantage of that since the ice is retreating and it's easier to get larger ships further north. And they're also trying to diversify into other areas. So it's not just, you know, the oil money comes in and gets dispersed. It's also they're trying to take advantage of other opportunities related to the fact that, you know, they're not locked in all the time by sea ice anymore.
Did you come away from the experience thinking the problems were worse than you thought, or do you feel there is still time to make big changes?
Well, speaking to some of the scientists that do the research up there, we spoke to both scientists who study oceanography and scientists who actually study sea life that's affected by ocean acidification. It seems like we don't have a lot of time to make significant changes that will make things better. And I'm by no means a scientist, and we generally actually cover education for the most part. But it seems like this is something that we need to pay attention to.
Yeah, and one of the scientists that we talked to had a good way of kind of breaking it down, I thought, for somebody that doesn't cover it. And the way that he described it just made a lot of sense, in the sense of, he said, you know, what we're seeing is temperatures are rising in the Arctic faster, about twice as fast as any place on the planet. And, you know, it's like a glass of water with ice in it. And the water's not going to get warm until you get rid of the ice. And that's essentially what's happening right now in the Arctic. Sea ice, the volume of sea ice is down by about 40% of what it was in the 1970s and 1980s. That was fairly frightening, actually, to kind of hear that, just put it that kind of way of like, wow, well, this is, you know, even a few decades ago, there was so much more ice than there used to be out on that sea. And that obviously has to have huge ramifications.
What do you ultimately hope to convey to viewers, and what message would you like them to take away?
I think that Alaska is typically not a place that a lot of journalists tend to go for stories. So I think that getting an opportunity to see how their lives are changing, since they're on the front lines, as scientists have said, on global climate change, you really get a sense of how it affects people. And if it affects them now, it could certainly affect others more seriously down the road. And with respect to the work that the scientists are doing, I think that particularly with ocean acidification and its effect on the marine food web, that affects us all outside of Alaska, even in the nearer term. Our oysters, our shellfish, they are just not as plentiful as they used to be. And it's attributed to this process, ocean acidification, which is sped up, apparently, by melting sea ice. So I think just general awareness certainly was one of the goals, and being able to show people places and things that they wouldn't normally get to see.
What were your moments of inspiration?
For me, it was just watching people hold these traditions so dearly and making a concerted effort to see that their children understand where they came from and why these things were important, and that they carry on kind of what people do in general when they're faced with challenges. We as people want our traditions to continue, and watching how hard they're struggling to do that against the face of Mother Nature was, it was I feel really fortunate that we were able to see that, that they were willing to share.
Yeah, I mean, the people and the places that we were able to see, I mean, the whole state is almost just impossibly beautiful. I mean, everywhere you turn is just kind of the most magnificent sunset you've ever seen, or the greatest view of the mountains with an ocean right there. And that's one thing that we were really surprised by about Barrow is, you know, we had really no idea what it was even going to look like, kind of. I mean, you know, some of the pictures you see online, it almost looks like the moon or something. But when you get up there, it just really, really has a lot of natural beauty. And the people there are just incredibly generous. And like April was saying, I mean, it was just a delight to actually get to know them and let them tell their story.
Anybody who's interested in seeing these pieces can go to our website, pbs.org/newshour. They will be on the climate change section, and I hope that people learn something, because I know I certainly did.
And what's next for the two of you?
We'll go back to American Graduate. We actually work together as education reporters and producers. And we, you know, for the 18 months before this trip, we were doing a story on dropout, the dropout crisis across America. And we'll kind of go back to general education reporting after this.
We just got a nice Arctic trip on our summer break.
Yeah.
That was April Brown and Mike Fritz, co-producers of a three-part series airing on the NewsHour broadcast the week of September 16 on the unexpected consequences of climate change. Thank you for listening. Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn, Susie Montgomery, and Elaine Taylor.
I never had seal. I did have muktuk, which is basically a layer of whale skin. And that was out while I was out with the Inupiats hunting. They offered me some while we were out. They said, oh, you got to try this, because they were having some. And I tried it. You know, it's not anything I would probably need to have anytime again real soon, but it was good. It tasted kind of like a beef jerky, a fish version of beef jerky, I would also say.
And then there's reindeer sausage, which is popular on a lot of menus as well. It wasn't my favorite food, but it wasn't bad.
That was pretty good, I thought.